Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. And she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.fm. The September 3rd, 2019 edition, episode 130 of Nature Bets Last, comes to you live from Rakino Island in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and from Westchester County, New York, in the United States. This is Kevin Hester, and I'm again joined today by my co-host, Professor Guy McPherson. Today's show includes a conversation with Arthur Keller. Guy, would you do the honors, please?
Thank you, Kevin. And big thanks, too, to my partner, Pauline Schneider, sometime co-host of this show, for suggesting we interview Arthur after seeing his latest presentation. You can view the resulting video on YouTube, and I will include a link in the archived description of this month's show. Beginning with a career as a rocket scientist, Keller has become an author, screenwriter, and keynote speaker. He has been a communications and strategic advisor for several nonprofit organizations, and he has worked with different groups specializing in safeguarding ecosystems and building societal resilience in the face of foreseeable shortages of strategic and vital resources. He is currently developing an original TV show that tells the intertwined stories of characters trying to become resilient in a general context of economic, social, and environmental breakdown due to critical shortages in necessary materials. Arthur, you study system dynamics. Let's start by having you tell us what that means. What is system dynamics?
Hi, thanks very much, Guy. Hi, Kevin. It's good to talk to you too. Hi.
Pleasure,
I hope the connection is good, because I'm... All right. So, yeah, excellent. System dynamics. It's one of my area of expertise, let's say. Although it wasn't at first, I became a specialist of that along the years. And it's proven to be a very useful tool to understand how complex systems evolve. Now, of course, it's very complicated to explain, unfortunately. Like, what is a system, first of all? A system is a number of elements, and it's especially a number... Well, each of those elements have proprieties. And also, it's a whole lot of relationships between those elements. It's how those elements interact with each other. So there are rules, laws, physical laws sometimes. It could be societal, cultural laws as well, when we try to model human societies. And then system dynamics tries to understand how all these things interact, and according to a number of principles, it could be things like rebound effects, or system like loops. Sorry about that, because I'm not used to talking about all this in English. I'm sorry, I'm French, for those who didn't understand that, and and English is not my primary language. Getting back to the topic. You have a number of effects that happen and dynamics within the system, which, if you understand them, make you sort of able to see where it's going. Like, you can't ever say what the trajectory of one element will be, but you can understand what the whole the whole behavior of the system will look like.
That's excellent, Arthur. And your English is absolutely perfect. Don't in any way underestimate how eloquent you are. You know, Guy and I have shared presentation titled Collapse, the Only Realistic Scenario. We've shared it widely in our social media circles, and that'll be because of this interview. And, of course, we'll include it in the show notes for future reference. Arthur, your work looks to me to be like a natural and honest scientific progression from the work of Joseph Tainter and his book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, the Club of Rome of Hugo Bardi's Seneca Cliff, and Albert Bartlett's presentation on the exponential function. Did these great pioneers influence your work in any way?
Yes, a lot. I'm an engineer myself at first, and I did a lot of science, like basic fundamental science, math and physics. And so at the very beginning of my career, professional career, I didn't know that much about system dynamics, about complexity, and about how complex systems evolve. I had no idea about that because I didn't actually study that during my studies. But it gave me the tools to understand what it was about. So over the years, I gradually became interested in that field, especially thanks to Joseph Tainter, to be honest. I had read, like many people, Collapse by Jared Diamond at first, and it was an inspiration because it's a really good book. However, I believe that it's not that rigorous from a scientific or technical point of view. And when I read Tainter, I found that book and the work, it's not just the book you were referring to. There's a lot of work that he did, which is very, very good and interesting. Are you still here?
Yes,
Tony, we're here.
Hello? Oh, sorry. I heard something over the phone. We had been cut off.
Go ahead.
Sorry, there's some lag. Tainter was very, very important in my personal understanding, my personal study of what I'm doing right now, understanding the vulnerabilities of complex systems, and also, of course, the limits to growth. And then there were other authors, obviously, who came later. Like Graham Turner and Hugo Bardi, who's an Italian physicist, great work as well. So yes, to answer your question, yes, those books you were referring to, those works, have been a great influence.
Thank you, Arthur. To our listeners, we will be taking your toll-free calls today. Please give us a call with your questions and comments after we spend a bit of time with our guest. We are most easily reached with a toll-free telephone call to 888-874-4888. Arthur, you present a series of phenomena that are characterized as exponential, as you just mentioned, playing off of the work of some of your predecessors. And that exponential function is a critical piece of your work. Now, why are you so certain we face a rapid collapse rather than a continued gradual descent that I hear a lot of people say, without evidence, by the way, that they believe will occur next? Why are you so certain that we are facing collapse in the near future, not in 100 years from now?
Okay, so there are two questions in one, actually, because you say rapid, and then you say 20 years and not 100 years from now. So it's rapid and imminent. It's the two different dimensions. The imminence of it, I'll get back to it afterwards. Let's just talk about the rapidity, the celerity of the whole phenomenon. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure it's going to go down very quickly. I mean, it's a personal hunch, and it's based on many, many studies. So I believe it's way more probable that it will happen like that. But also, I know that my own intuition doesn't count. Someone's intuition doesn't count. That's one of the problems that we have. People rely too much on their own intuition for things. So should be careful. What I believe is that there will be a collapse a general global collapse over the next decades. But we're talking global average, and if you look at what decades are in the global average, it's really, really, really fast indeed. Now, for everyone, the collapse will look different. It's like when you talk about a general global collapse, it has no actual physical meaning. It's just averages. It's just numbers, big numbers. Now, everyone wants to know what will happen for himself or herself and for their community or country maybe. And that I can't understand. I can't answer because it will be very different depending on the places. So what I can say is that in every place, it will go more or less, and that will depend on resilience, how resilient the system is. Now, people talk about resilience not the same way that I do, most people. I'm talking about community resilience, and I'm talking about systemic resilience, not resilience in the face of a specific event, for example, a drought or, I don't know, a terrorist attack, for example, or anything else. Places can be very resilient to different types of phenomena or events, but I'm talking about systemic resilience, meaning are we resilient in the face of a general collapse where you have your whole commercial system, your whole political and cultural and social system, which actually collapses. And that, there are actually no resilient systems in the world right now, except on the local scale. So on the local scale, you could be resilient locally in a general context of collapse. And so everything for everyone will depend on how resilient they are locally, meaning how they have managed to build strong relationships, human relationships, and the strong relationships with the nature and resources that they have around them as well. What I believe, and I'm ending my reply with this point, what I believe is that almost everywhere it will be a gradual collapse until we reach the tipping point, or one tipping point, because there will be tipping points pretty much everywhere. If you look at complex systems, be it ecosystems, be it a structure, like, for example, a car, or a body, or like my body, for example. If you look at anything like that, you can apply pressure, constraints to that system, and the system will deform. It will adapt to a certain point. If it's a really healthy system, it will adapt more than if it's already weak before. But for each system, there is a breaking point. And then you have the rapid collapse you were talking about, Guy. So to sum it up, a very general global slow collapse, slow meaning over decades, which is actually pretty fast. And everywhere you have gradual collapse until you reach the tipping point, and then you have your very rapid collapse. That's what I believe.
Excellent. Now, what factors do you think could contribute to a rapid collapse? What sorts of phenomena or issues could contribute to a rapid as opposed to a relatively gradual collapse?
Difficult question, because there are many possibilities. From what I've read, I tend to think that it will probably come in many places from the financial world. We will have, sooner than later, I fear, we will have another banking system collapse. We will have one in the next few years, I believe. We'll see. I'm in no place to actually. I'm no banker myself, but I'm just reading what a number of experts write about that. And also, it'll have a direct impact on energy, on the energy systems. Those are very linked, by the way. Even if people fail to understand that, the energy production industry and the economy are completely linked. So it's going to be from either one or the other, probably both. And then there are going to be many dominoes. You know, the domino effect will, as I said, be very different depending on the places. Because everywhere you are, there are problems, there are issues. In some places, those issues are political. In other problems, they're ethnical, religious, or they're linked to resources like fossil fuels or water. Anyway, every place you have those problems. And what's going to happen when the collapse happens is that it's going to look exactly like the problems that were there before. So if you had inter-ethnic issues already before, well, obviously, this is when it's going to break. The whole system is going to start breaking from that angle, let's say. And I fear that many analysts, they're going to see a number of crises emerging pretty much everywhere, and they're going to fail to understand the underlying principles, the common denominators. They will only see what happens on the surface, and they will say, oh, here we have an ethnic problem, and here we have a war for resources, and here we have geopolitical issues, blah, blah, blah. But they will fail to understand that it's coming from the energy system, from ecological degradation as well. And, of course, it's going to manifest through the financial and economic systems.
Right, and it seems like given the link between industrial activity and global dimming, or the aerosol masking effect, here I'm quoting a recent paper in Science from February 8th of this year by Daniel Rosenfeld and colleagues. Rosenfeld was the lead author, and he suggests that a global average rise in temperature of 1 degree Celsius could result from somewhere in the 18 to 20% reduction in industrial activity. So if we're headed for that sort of reduction in industrial activity, that could trigger a very rapid global average increase in temperature that I doubt we or very many other species would be able to react to. So can you walk us through a little bit the relationship between the economic system or the industrial economy system and how that plays into habitat for our species and others? And I know you're not a biologist by education, so go as far as you'd like with this question.
Thanks. No, I'm not a biologist. I'm not a climate scientist either, though I've read a lot about it, and I've reached some sort of competence, but no, it's not my field. So I know about global dimming, and specifically aerosols, the aerosol masking effect. From what I understand, it's an effect that we say, I mean, we've said until now, until recently, that actually had a big impact between, let's say, the middle of the last century and the mid-80s. And we believe that for those 35 years, pretty much, the aerosols masked the actual, to some extent, it masked the actual warming dynamic. But then, from the mid-80s on, the dimming effect slowed down, or we thought it almost disappeared, and then we could see the actual warming trends much better. From what I understand, some work, the one you're referring to, and another one, I think, but I can't remember which one, tend to conclude that we've actually underestimated that dimming effect, and that today there still is a lot of dimming effect going on, and that if it were to stop or diminish, then the warming trend would increase, the rate of warming would increase much, and we would realize that climate sensitivity is actually higher than we thought. It is, I fear, possible. But as I say, I'm no climate scientist, so I leave science to it, meaning that now that it's out, those conclusions and studies are out, well, I'm waiting for the scientific community, the specialists, to exchange thoughts on this, and we'll see if it's true or not. Now, if it is, well, it's worrying, because as you say, if our society degrowths, which will happen, because it's bound to happen, we can talk about it later if you want. If that happens, then industrial output, industrial production, will decrease. The emission of aerosols will decrease as well. And well, you got it. You got it. The rate of warming will increase. So yes, I'm afraid, but I can't comment further on that, because as I said, it's not my field.
Arthur, what has been your personal response to the conclusions that you've come to when you've put this study together about collapse? How has it changed your life and relation and your relationships, both personal and professional?
Wow. I'm no example to follow, I guess. What I'm doing, let's start by saying that I haven't figured it out all of a sudden. There hasn't been one key moment where I just realized that, oh my God, we're in deep shit. That never happened. I understood that a long time ago. I've been studying this for 20 years, and it's been very, very gradual. Now, what I've been trying to do for 20 years or so, let's say 15, what I've been trying to do is not read everything that could confirm these theories of collapse, but I've been trying to do exactly the opposite, trying to read things that would make me understand that it was a false alarm. But any time I read articles or papers that concluded that it was a false alarm, there were major flaws, major methodological flaws, and very often ideological.
Have lost our guest. All right, PRN right. Are getting him back. We should have him back with us within a few seconds.
I'd just like to make a comment. You know, the February paper from Rosenfeld and colleagues in Science indicates that a global average temperature rise of 1 degree would result from 18% to 20% reduction in industrial activity. If this is the case, then the aerosol masking effect alone could cause the 5 to 6 degree Celsius global average rise in temperature that Strona and Bradshaw indicated would cause extinction of all life on Earth in their paper published in Scientific Reports in November of 2018. So I just wanted to mention that for our audience, and particularly in light of groups such as Deep Green Resistance, and especially its figurehead, along with Idle No More, and several individual activists who promote not only degrowth, but complete collapse of industrial civilization. So, doing so could actually lead to the loss of all life on Earth, the worst extinction event in history. And so continuing to call for the complete collapse of industrial civilization at the global level seems a little disingenuous for those groups who claim to be making this call on behalf of life on Earth. Kevin, did you want to comment about that?
Oh, yeah, I've been an anti-capitalist pretty much all my life, and I've been sticking my leg out trying to trip it over to get it to fall. And now I realize, because of the aerosol masking effect, when it falls, it lands directly on top of me.
Right.
And that's why, a lot of us who have been following the economic Ponzi scheme that's been operating on the planet and see how fragile it is, we now know that a major economic collapse could actually trigger a biosphere collapse. The pathos and irony of it is extraordinary.
Right. Yeah, and like you, I used to be a big fan of slowing the omnicide or even stopping the omnicide associated with industrial civilization. I get it. I understand that part. But then you connect a few dots, and it becomes obvious that the situation is far worse than we ever imagined. In fact, Jackson Davis, friend of this show, wrote me some information last night or this morning indicating that Benjamin Franklin was writing about the aerosol masking effect, not calling it by that name, in 1783. So the people pulling the strings of empire, that's not you and me, by the way, actually have known about the aerosol masking effect, have known about global dimming for a long, long time. I relatively recently, again from Jackson Davis, came across a peer-reviewed journal article on the topic in 1929. And yet, the first paper I read about it was by Hansen and colleagues in December 2011. And they didn't quote any of the previous literature, and including two papers from the early 1990s. So I was confused. I made decisions based on incomplete information that I later realized were terrible mistakes. And by continuing to ignore the aerosol masking effect, I suspect we're taking a lot of people down that same road of making mistakes based on absence of information or complete ignorance of information. Did you want to comment on that a little bit, Kevin?
I am very, I'd have to say, suspicious of why Hansen et al. Did not cross-reference those previous papers. That is almost always, when science deals with a new or a recently new phenomenon, whatever peer-reviewed science has previously been on the subject is almost always cross-referenced. It's very strange that they made a decision to ignore that earlier work.
Right, and especially when you consider that the conclusion by Hansen and colleagues was very, very close to the conclusion reached by that 1929 paper. So the magnitude of the aerosol masking effect was virtually identical, and yet there was no mention of the previous work. So that's a little conspicuous, I'd say.
Yeah, it doesn't add up, as like so much of what we're seeing doesn't add up. I think while we're waiting for Arthur to come back on, I'd like to have a little talk about censorship, which is something that we can talk about without him, because it was a sort of a byline subject. But what we've noticed just recently is that Facebook and Twitter are both censoring a whole lot of information on the net, and they're very selective about it. So I think we all should all start being very wary about how much censorship is taking place and how quickly the dominant culture could cut off all this kind of talk. We're starting to see it now, and I wouldn't surprise me one day to wake up and Guy McPherson and Kevin Hester be off the line.
Yeah, you know, in particular, there's this presentation and interview by BBC's Hard Talk of Roger Hallam, who we interviewed on this show. And Roger Hallam, I don't think, and I suspect you don't think, Kevin, is going nearly far enough with his presentation. He rarely, if ever, talks about the aerosol masking effect. He rarely, if ever, talks about self-reinforcing feedback loops. He's stuck on the 2100 timeline. And yet, several groups on Facebook have been warned that sharing the video from his latest presentation will get you in serious trouble because they view that as fake news. This is absolutely insane.
And it's also what we should expect. The dominant culture has had a long time to prepare for this imminent crash. And they're as cunning as ditch rats. To think that they wouldn't have a plan and a strategy in place would be naive of us. I'll give another example about what people are talking about and what they're not. A lot of these organizations, including Extinction Rebellion, are talking about cutting emissions, but none of them ever talk about militarism.
Right. They're calling for people like you and I to cut our emissions. And I wrote about this in my latest paper in Clinical Psychology Forum when I drew a parallel between the halfway information presented by climate scientists and the halfway presentation of information that come from most grief specialists. And in particular, I was focusing on the aerosol masking effect and self-reinforcing feedback loops with respect to climate. And with respect to grief counseling or grief therapy, I was talking about grief recovery. And as I pointed out in that paper, which came out in the September issue of Clinical Psychology Forum, there are two organizations I know about that are focused on grief recovery that instead of constantly battering people over the head with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief that she described in her 1969 book, that there's also a way forward. There's something called grief recovery as presented by the Grief Recovery Institute and also by the Only Love Remains workshop that I put together with my partner, Pauline. So, and again, it seems to me that it all points in one direction. It all points in the direction of a relatively few people making a lot of money, continuing to make a lot of money in a system gone awry.
I would like to bring up a subject that's going to make me extraordinarily unpopular, but I'm going there anyway. And that's, I want to talk about the Greta Thunberg sail across the Atlantic. As Guy knows, I'm a former offshore blue water sailor. I've done 16 ocean passages on cruising yachts. The boat that Greta Thunberg was on going across the Atlantic would have cost millions of dollars to make. And then it would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to prepare for that trip. I've done a lot of offshore passages. I know how much preparation has to go into it. And I just think that people are just being fooled with this. It's just always another diversion. Hey, I've got some great news. We have Arthur back on. Arthur, are you there, sir?
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. You know, apparently the collapse will start with the phone system.
Okay, don't worry about it. No problem at all. Hey, Arthur, your cutting-edge analysis, did that level of activism come naturally to you as a scientist, or was that something that your science threw you into?
My activism, you say?
Yes, well, you know, that presentation is, in itself, is activism. It's a very forthright and challenging piece of work. So effectively, that becomes activism in this day and age. Were you a natural activist to do that, or was that just the byproduct of your science?
All right. There is, in what I'm doing, there is a sense of duty, I guess. And I believe I have to do what I'm doing. But I believe I am an activist deep down. However, I try not to it's a hard question. I try not to behave like an activist. Because I try to be as rigorous as I can. My work, I try to make it as scientific as possible, so that it's hard to classify me as someone who speaks because he has ideals or an ideology, or it's not ideological for me. It is not. The only ideology that defines me would be life. Protecting life. Is that an ideology? Or should that be the goal of everyone, really, deep down, and the only one, really? So, yeah, that's my only ideology, if you want to call it that. Then, for the rest, I'm not taking part in demonstrations. I do not actually write theses or texts to call for political action. I myself have written political programs, but they were only very pragmatic measures and propositions to make the system resilient. So, yes, I'm an activist deep down, otherwise I wouldn't do what I'm doing. But my activity is not that of an activist. It's that of a specialist trying to provide with helpful insight and ideas.
Absolutely, you did. I think that's a fine line that a lot of trouble with about where they draw that Rubicon between their work and their belief systems and what, if activism, if you'd like to call it that. Hey, there's one other thing from your presentation that I knew it, but I'd sort of forgotten about it, and you reminded me, and that's with regard to the IPCC and the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and how it includes the imperative to maintain economic growth. How do we decouple and maintain infinite growth on a finite planet?
I think that's Kevin's attempted stand-up. Obviously, we can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. To believe that, you'd have to be an economist or a fool, as an economist pointed out a long time ago. His name escapes me right now. Please give us a toll-free call with your questions or comments for us or our guests. The easiest way to reach us is via toll-free call at 888-874-4888. Another question for you, Arthur. You envision massive human dieback with reduction of food or reduction of supply chains. Sorry, apparently we lost our guest, and so I'm going to wait to repeat the question. But if you have a question for us or our guest, please give us a quick holler. Dan from Detroit. That was fast. Go ahead, Dan.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead and ask.
Yes. Can you hear me? Can you hear
yes,
me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, how are you today, Kevin and
good,
guys?
Thanks.
My name is Dan. I'm calling from Detroit. I just wanted to say what a positive influence you've been on my life since I discovered your work on about climate change and the sixth mass extinction. I wasn't aware of these phenomena until I discovered your work in November of 2018. And thanks for doing what most individuals in industrial civilization have never done, which is choose right action, abandon the system, and live off-grid. We should be thanking you for doing the right thing, for the information that you've had on climate change at the time, you know? And I don't think you get thanked enough because not many individuals chose what you chose to do, so...
Well, thank you for that comment, Dan. I appreciate it very much. I think there's a reason most individuals didn't choose my path. Most people are a lot smarter than I am.
Yeah, I served in the military for 8 years, and I grinded the planet to dust just like everybody else. I'm a truck driver. I always wanted to hop out of the monetary system. It just, once you start making that money, it's like it's a monkey trap, like you said. You can't get away from it. It's very hard to release. And you were able to make those steps. And for what you knew at the time, you didn't know much about the aerosol masking effect. You chose right action. And so that's kind of how I'm living right now, is, you know, with right action, even though I'm still grinding the planet in the dust by truck driving.
Well, you know, you could argue convincingly, given the aerosol masking effect, that we should all be driving those coal burners that have become so popular amongst Trump supporters in the Deep South, that the thing we should be doing is putting those particulates up into the atmosphere. But I appreciate your comment very much, Dan. Thank you for calling in. Apparently, our guest is back.
Yes, I am.
Arthur, are you with us? Excellent.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so I had a question for you that I asked when you weren't with us. So you envision a massive human dieback with a reduction of food or a reduction of some other elements critical to maintaining industrial civilization. So you foresee this massive human dieback, and in your presentation you presented a bell-shaped curve or something resembling a bell-shaped curve that flattens out in apparently in decades or centuries even. We still have a relatively small human population on the planet. why not extinction, given the recent work indicating that the rapidity of change is outstripping the ability of vertebrates and mammals to keep up, and the obvious consequent meltdown of the world's 400-plus nuclear power plants when civilization goes away. Mm-hmm. Why not extinction? Or do you think that's even possible? I'm trying to probe here to see how far you think we'll go. How low do you think we'll go? Will there be 12 of us or none?
Okay, let me just I'll answer that. And after, if you accept, I'd like to go back to the decoupling question because it's a very important one, which unfortunately I haven't been able to answer on air. But let's go to what you're telling me. I can't rule it out. The extinction, like extinctions are going on, are taking place right now. Many species are going extinct as we speak, and it's a massive ecological collapse that's actually happening now. Now, when we talk about collapse, we sort of have an anthropocentric vision of it, like, oh, what's going to happen to us? But it's happening right now. There's a collapse when you look at the biosphere, life on Earth. There's a collapse when you look at the climate system, the atmosphere and the hydrosphere, the waters, and the cryosphere, the ice. There's a collapse when you look at the pedosphere, that's the soil. It's happening right now. And we are actually reaching a lot of limits when it comes to the lithosphere, which is the crust, the mantle of the planet. We're extracting fossil fuels and metals and a number of ores from. And we're reaching limits there as well. Sometimes it's geological limits. Sometimes it has to do with our capability to provide the resources to societies so that they can function. Anyway, we're reaching everywhere we look at limits and collapse dynamics. Now, why wouldn't we collapse as well? Why wouldn't we go extinct as well? I don't have an opinion on that. I believe it's possible. Of course it is. It's highly possible. It's highly possible that all life on Earth could disappear. Now, I don't think it's likely, but it's possible. And again, my intuition, my opinion is irrelevant. I try not to pay too much attention to that. There's what I know and what I feel. What I feel, I keep to myself. So all I can say is that it's a possibility. Now, can I get back to the decoupling question, Paul?
Yes, yes, please do.
Thanks very much. As you were saying, Kevin, the UNFCCC, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, it's the text which all UN climate conferences are based on, says that one of the goals is to create sustainable economic growth. So they, in the DNA of everything that's done at the UN level and levels below, is the belief, but it's a belief, that it's possible to decouple economic growth from the impact we have on the planet, be it the resources we use, be it the pollution we create and reject, or be it destruction, the ecological degradation we cause. And we believe we can decrease all these trends while maintaining economic growth. Well, it never happens. Doesn't mean it can never happen, but it never happened. And the problem is that if you look at the trends, now the first, there's a question that's very important. Decoupling from what? Is what do we decouple from what else? If it's economic growth, i.e. GDP, from GHG emissions, then it might be possible to decouple those, but only locally, maybe a country, and only temporarily. You can't maintain an absolute decoupling, meaning economic growth will that GDP will go up and the emissions will go down. You can't reach that in the long run. You can't. We've never done it, and nothing points to our capability of doing it. Now, in different places, they have managed to decouple momentarily, like temporarily. For example, in the UK, they've phased out coal pretty much. And as they were doing that, they've maintained economic growth, although lower than what they expected. And they've and while they were maintaining this growth, GHG emissions would go down. Even considering imported emissions and stuff, it still went down. But it lasted just for a few years. Now it's back on track. And now there's just a relative decoupling, meaning the economy grows faster than GHG emissions, but the emissions are growing nonetheless. So absolute decoupling hasn't lasted for very long. And that's pretty much the best we can do. Now, if you look at material use, the decoupling between the GDP and how much material we use, well, there's no decoupling at all. There was some relative decoupling in the past, but now, for the last 20 years, it's been a recoupling. It's been an overcoupling, I should say, meaning that we use more and more material just for the same amount of economic output. So if you look at the last reports from the International Resource Panel from the UN, or if you look at a study by Jason Hickel and Georgios Kallis, which is called Is Green Growth Possible? They study the trends, and you see that it takes us more and more material to produce 1 point of GDP. The last thing is, if you look at the decoupling between growth, economic growth, and ecological destruction, there is no decoupling. The more we produce, the more we destroy, period. And that's why our whole civilization is one thing, and but one thing. It's a big machine of annihilation of life. That's actually what it is. And like the species we talked about that go extinct, they don't disappear. They disappear as a consequence of our ways of life. And of course, I don't want to say to people that they're guilty of that. Most people, they're not, or they didn't know. But now we understand. And we understand that our whole societies are based on plundering resources and killing the planet. So it's pretty much good news, after all, that it's not going to last much longer. But now, good news for whom? Did you hear the whole thing?
Yes, I understand. Thank you for that very thoughtful response. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, go ahead, please.
So what is your advice? What do we do in light of this knowledge? Even if the aerosol masking effect doesn't exist, most of us depend upon industrial civilization for the food we buy and so on. So how should we act as individuals and as a society? Do you have any advice to leave us with? Because we're nearing the end of the show here.
All right. First, we get out of denial. We stop feeling invulnerable. Like the more invulnerable you feel, the less you prepare, and the more vulnerable you actually are. And we can prepare ourselves socially. Individually as well, of course, but if you only do it individually, it's bound to fail. You have to do it together. And you build resilience. What does it mean? It means that you should not try, you should no longer, let's say, try to solve the problems, because they're systemic problems which call for systemic solutions. So the only solution, so to speak, that you could come up with would be to change the whole system. But you can't. You can't change the civilization. So what you have to do is change civilizations, is building another one in parallel. When I say another one, I mean lots of other ones. I mean local, territorial societies. So resilience, you build them with people you know. You build them, you build resilience, you create a balance between you and other communities, and with ecosystems, if you know what you interact with. So you have to know each other and work with each other. I'm saying that I don't want to be candid or look or sound candid. I'm not. There will be violence, and you should prepare for that. However, you should not be obsessed with violence, because if you have, you know, bunkers and weapons, and your whole vision of the world is about balance of power and domination and fear, if you have a warmongering culture, it doesn't work. It won't work. You won't be resilient. What you're going to do is create the conditions for conflict where you are. And if you're one of the few that survive, good for you, but your life will be unbearable. So if you want to live correctly and sustainably, you have to work together. Resilience, it's not something that you should come up with the way you feel it. Resilience has its principles and fundamentals. You need to have buffers, meaning, I know, stocks. I'm not saying hoarders are right, but to some extent they are, because it allows you to pass difficult moments if need be. So that's one of the things. You need barriers. Wherever you are, you need to know what the dangers are, where your flaws or vulnerabilities are, and you need to build barriers for that. For example, Fukushima, well, dams bigger dams would have been a good barrier. If you live down a slope of a mountain, you should as well build protections from possible avalanches or whatever. Now, information is key as well. You need to share information. You need to have a system that allows you to know and share information so that whenever something bad or good arrives, you can anticipate on that. And you can either get help or go and help your neighbors. Redundancy. You should not depend on anything which is critical. If it goes down, if it breaks down, what happens? Never let that happen. So redundancy. Double every critical system. You need to work on your needs. What is it? Is it the more the better and you still accumulate wealth and material equipment? No, we know that. Now we know that it doesn't make you happier. So let's move past that and let's work on our needs. It's like technology. Do we need to put technology everywhere? Technology is not, it is material. It relies on a lot of materials and ores, metals. For instance, if we replace, to some extent, of course, if we replace fossil fuels by electric cars and solar panels and wind turbines and stuff, it's okay. It's a little better in some respect, but then what happens that your dependency shifts from a dependency to the oil producing countries to a dependency on China mainly, which produces whatever rare earths are needed for those technological devices. So let's move past technology as well. Technology is useful only if it makes us less dependent, because right now it turns us into junkies, and we have to put a little wisdom into that. So I would finish by saying that it has to work together in a network. You have to create a network with complementarity and solidarity, otherwise it won't work. And you have to do it at the right scale. It's not a city. City is too big. Maybe it's districts within a city. It's not one person or a family or a few friends, because it's too small, and you won't have enough. You won't have the amount of skills and knowledge that it takes to actually be sustainably resilient. So the right scale is pretty much the county, or the town or neighboring villages, something like that. If we all work together at this scope, and if we start talking about the problems right now instead of dodging them, instead of denying them, we may have a chance to actually be resilient and live decent lives in the forthcoming decades, I believe.
Well, thank you for that.
Go on, Guy.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, that's an absolutely brilliant way for us to bring this wonderful interview to an end, Arthur. I agree completely. Now's the time for us to, no more important time in history to form a tribe. I'd like to thank our contributors and listeners today and Dan, who called in, as well as FZN for our theme music. You can catch NBL on PRN the first Tuesday of the month at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's October the 1st. Thank you so much for your time, Arthur, and we'll stay in touch. Keep up the wonderful work.
Thanks a lot to you too.
Yes, thank you very much, Arthur. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Have a good night. It was a pleasure for me.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.